You're listening to the Q's Podcast, episode 99. Hello, welcome to the 99th installment of the Q's Podcast. My name is James Lenz, Q's Professional Development Manager, Editor, and Host of the show. We are nearly ready to release the special 100th episode show. Listeners, thank you for submitting those questions we've been asking about in recent shows and in social media as well. All questions were absolutely fantastic. It was a tough decision. From those lists of submitted questions, we have selected some of them to serve as the foundation for the next show. Lisa Holgraf, Q's senior editor and co-host of the show, and I have just completed recording subject matter expert responses to support those listener questions. We'll offer at least two different voices or two perspectives to respond to each question. We are in the final stages of production. I can't wait to reveal to you who those special guests will be. It's a big show. It'll be an episode to remember, so keep listening. Now, for this important message: industry veterans, reliable, high-performing, quality. Those are just a few of the terms used to describe Harlan Clark and his solutions. For more than 145 years, Harlan Clark has served financial institutions, helping clients better engage with their customers to build loyal, lasting relationships. It's no different today. You can count on Harlan Clark for strategic check, card, contact center, digital, direct marketing, and acquisition solutions that deliver superior customer experiences, create brand differentiation, and drive positive bottom-line results. With Harlan Clark as your partner, you can count on a single trusted resource with the industry expertise, business insight, and best practice capabilities to successfully execute your business strategy. Visit harlanclark.com to learn more. Now, our guest for today's show is an associate professor at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. This individual teaches the required first-year course on leading organizations in the MBA program and elective courses on the topic of leadership development in both the MBA and executive MBA programs. His research addresses how organizational and societal contexts affect leader-follower dynamics. His work has been featured in outlets such as the New York Times, Washington Post, CNBC, Forbes, Fast Company, Inc., Harvard Business Review, Boston Globe, and Comedy Central. Let me introduce you to the one and only Dr. Sean Martin. Hey, Sean, welcome to the show. Thanks for being a guest in the Q's Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, James. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Sean, sometimes we start the show with a bit of perspective from our guest to share upon our listeners, maybe sometimes to add a bit of inspiration. So I wanted to inquire with you, do you have a success quote or mantra that you'd be willing to share with our listeners?
Well, I mean, I guess so. I don't know how inspirational it would be necessarily, but it is something that I is near and dear to my heart. It's a quote that is... I think it's attributed to a lot of people, and it's really of unknown origin, but essentially the phrase is, a person who stands for nothing falls for everything. And the reason that that quote is so meaningful to me is I think it speaks to the importance of values, having values, standing up for them, letting other people know what they are so that people know what you're about. And, you know, life presents us every once in a while with these opportunities to show people who the heck we are and show people what we're about and what is important to us. And, you know, that quote reminds me in those moments that it's worthwhile to stand up to the opportunity, meet it head on, and show people your values and what you're willing to stand for, and that you're not going to be easily pushed over and not going to sacrifice the person you want to be.
Thanks for sharing, Sean. I appreciate your perspective. Now, Sean, it's pretty clear to me that you have a passion for sports and for drawing on sports to teach lessons in business. So my first question is, what is your favorite sport and why?
Well, yeah, I guilty as charged. I love sports. A lot of my teaching does involve lessons from sports. My favorite sport, I think, is probably basketball. And the reason why is it's a sport that I played a lot when I was younger, and I have a lot of good memories about it. My dad, when I was a young boy, used to take me to a lot of San Antonio Spurs games. This is back before they even started this historic 22-year-long playoff run that finally ended this season. But I have great memories of basketball growing up. And then as I grew to be older and learn more about organizations and teams and how they function, I really think a lot of the dynamics that we teach and talk about are readily observable in basketball for a number of reasons, some of which are, you know, just have to do with the uniforms people wear. Basketball is one of the sports where you can just see everybody's facial expressions. You can see their emotions on the court. You can see what they do and don't like when it's happening on the court. It's harder to do in sports where people wear masks or where you have to pan really far away from the game to be able to see all the action. So basketball is a very emotional sport that way. But also, it's just constant motion, and you can tell a lot about who is on good terms with one another and who plays what role in an organization very clearly from watching the action on the floor. It's also relatively small teams, so people who tend to be leaders on basketball teams tend to have a tremendous amount of influence in the locker room among the 12 to 15 other people they play with, whereas it tends to be a bit more diffuse when you have a sport like football, where there's very clear leaders, but there are offense leaders, there are defense leaders, and there's at any given time between 53 and probably 70 plus people around a locker room. So I find that there's a lot of reasons that basketball takes a lot of team dynamics and a lot of leadership lessons and distills them in a way that is very clear for people who might not even know much about sports to understand, watch, think about, talk about. You know, even if you're not a sports person, you can watch a clip and see that something's exciting. You can see a person's facial expressions. You can see who's getting the ball more. You can see who's supposed to be doing most of the defensive and rebounding work, who's supposed to be shooting the most. You can tell these types of things. And you can tell when things are going wrong very easily, too. And there's just a tremendous amount of statistics to track all of this. So as I guess partly for the nostalgic side, it's from when I was a kid. And then as an organizational scholar, it's because I like to nerd out about the statistics and a lot of the lessons we can learn from the theory and practice of leadership within the sport.
Basketball, one of my favorite sports as well. I played a little bit in college, but maybe not so much as you play, but certainly after you play sports, you can see how the lessons you learn on the court or in the field play over to other parts of your life and family and in leadership and in business. There's a lot of parallels, a lot of analogies, I bet, that you can share with your MBA students and students of your executive education program.
The other good thing about it is, like, it's much easier to keep score, for lack of a better phrase. Like, it's actually pretty easy to tell in sports who's performing the most effectively on various types of dimensions. So like when we talk about leadership, one of the things I try to really impress upon my students is there's more than just winning and losing. Now, the good thing about using sports as a metaphor in the classroom is that wins and losses are very easy to see. In the business world, they're sometimes harder to see. A lot of what we do these days is service oriented. Quality is pretty subjective. How much something is worth is kind of subjective. In sports, it's a 1-0. You won or you lost, right, on that dimension. But other dimensions that are really important for leadership are things like, is the team functioning cohesively as a unit? Is the team getting better the longer it's together, or is it fracturing the longer it's together? And you can tell a lot about that by, like, how long has each player been with the team? Do they choose to stay there, or do they try to roll off and go somewhere else? Can they not stand being there? You can also tell a lot of things from sports around, like, this is another dimension of leadership effectiveness, would be, are individuals getting better as just individual contributors the longer they're with the team? Are they developing new skills and abilities? Are they able to continue to add more value to the team the longer they're there? Or do they get worse or just stall out? You know, you take teams like my favorite team, it's like we mentioned, the San Antonio Spurs. They are famous for having very long tenured players that stay there a long time, and players that show up there and perform, you know, far exceeding what anybody would have expected from them before they got there. And then if they ever do leave, they go back to where they were. And a big part of the reason why that is the Spurs have created an organization and a culture that allows people to grow and develop and serve a very clear function on the team. And they've created a culture that people want to be with for a long time. So those are other dimensions of effectiveness that you can see in sports, but we don't often pay attention to. And we're just focused on wins and losses and exciting individual performance.
I like that you mentioned culture. Certainly, culture building is huge. It's a big part of any organization. It also sounds like you would be quite a fine coach as well, Sean.
I hope that's in my future. You know, I got two kids. You might be able to hear them in the background. They're waving at me right now. I got a 3- and a 5-year-old, and they are absolutely wonderful. And I do hope eventually coaching will be in my future as I get to coach their little teams. It'll be great.
That was a fun way to open. Moving on, as part of the faculty at the University of Virginia, you study how organizational and societal contexts affect leader-follower dynamic. Can you talk a bit about ways you see that the context of the COVID-19 pandemic have impacted the leader-follower dynamic?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's also a very big question. So I'll do a little ramp up of kind of like what I do and what I study, and then I think how it's relating to COVID right now. So in terms of, you know, my teaching interests, I teach and I'm a scholar of leadership specifically, right? And so I study a lot about what kinds of behaviors can relate to effectiveness along those dimensions we talked about, wins and losses, individuals getting better, teams getting better. And that's the kind of stuff I try to teach my students, and I try to help them develop some core leadership competencies. And my research interests that I try to, you know, get out into scholarly journals has to do with leadership, but specifically around issues of social class and leadership, and around how the ways that we grew up, the social class contexts that we were in, the access that we had or didn't have to wealth and resources has shaped some of our interpersonal dynamics and some of our skills and abilities in unique ways that manifest themselves when people come into organizational contexts. And I give you that little bit of preamble to say, I feel like COVID has had big general effects on leadership. So at the high level of the teaching interests around just core leadership topics around behaviors and effectiveness, but it also speaks to, we're learning a lot about how social class dynamics are playing out in this pandemic, right? So in the context of COVID, from the general high level leadership side, more general leader behavior side, one of the things that I see is we are increasingly realizing the importance of trust. Trust is something that is, you know, as my parents used to say when I was a kid, right? It's like it's gained in drops and lost in buckets. Mm. You know, it's something that you have to work at with your followers to build. And people will choose to trust you to the extent that they believe they, A, you have the skills to do a job. They can trust your abilities. You have the technical know-how to do things. B, that you have the integrity that they can trust that you're not going to tell them a lie, you're not going to misrepresent things, you're not going to ignore the truth. And then C, trust in your benevolence, really. Trust in that you actually have a sense of care and concern and empathy for them. To the extent that people, that you have those three dimensions, that you are benevolent and have good intentions for them, you want the best for them, that they can trust the things that you say and you're not going to mislead them, and you have the skills and abilities to do the job, then we can say that you are a trusted leader. That's really hard to do virtually. It's not impossible, but when we're in a virtual environment and when people are, you know, not able to interact face to face, or when we're having interactions over just the phone, when all we can hear is each other's voices, or when we have to stay 6 feet apart, or when we're all wearing masks, that presents a lot of challenges for how do we express empathy effectively. How do we really show people how much we care? Are we taking the time to build relationships when people are distanced? And now, like, I take my own situation, right? And I know other people are dealing with much, 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 much harder situations than mine. But I think about, I haven't left my house in months, right? James, I'm sure you're in a similar situation. And because I'm in my house, I'm still doing my work as a Darden professor, and I'm also homeschooling my kids, I'm really busy. I'm busier than I was when I was going to the office every day, because I teach my kids for 8 hours a day. Then I try to do my professor responsibilities for 8 hours a day. And then I try to sleep for the last 8 hours. And that's 6 to 7 days a week now. So when you have a bunch of followers who are that busy, or more so at their homes, or who are taking on additional risk by not being at home, and having their essential workers have to go to their job every single day where they're scared, right? In those kinds of environments where people are stressed and strained and they're having to be socially distant, it's very, very hard to, A, demonstrate that you have their best interests in mind, but it's especially important to. It's hard to, B, be honest about how much we do and don't know, and be honest about what our concerns are, to show that they can trust our integrity. And doing that, I think, is the real challenge of this era. How do leaders make time when they're already busy, and make... How do they express the emotional intelligence required to reach out to people and call them, check in with them via Zoom, just send them an email and let them know that you're thinking about them and that you want the things to be okay for them? How do you, you know, open up and show the vulnerability to be honest around what we do and don't know and what the future might or might not hold for us, the uncertainty therein? That goes against a lot of people's implicit beliefs about what leaders should do, which is project strength, all the time and have a commanding direction where we're all pointing, you know, and creating a compelling vision that everybody can follow. And it's like, it's really hard to create a compelling vision. We don't know what we're facing. You know, I think it requires a different set of leadership behaviors. And that set of leadership behaviors is much more oriented to the small day-to-day caring for your followers and caring for one another than it might otherwise be the case if we were all in offices and seeing each other more regularly. So it's a long-winded answer, but I think at the high level leadership, the real crux that we have to try to work through, the real challenge we all have to work through is how do we, in this environment, create trust and show people we care, show people our integrity and our honesty, and show people that we have the skills and abilities to execute through this. I actually think right now, and forgive me again if I'm rambling here, but I actually think right now, one of the things that we're suffering from is we are seeing the effects of a lot of leaders who haven't done that and now are scrambling to try to do that work now. And it's much harder to do that work now if you haven't done the work beforehand. If you've done the work and you have incredible trust from your followers, this time period is going to go more easily for you, right? Because people will trust that you are doing the things that need to be done to care for them and to care for the success of the organization. If you're trying to establish that trust now, you're really fighting an uphill battle. I mean, you still should continue doing the work, but sadly, I think we're realizing the importance of trust in hindsight, right? And the importance of making those connections in hindsight. The second piece, the social class piece, is I think we're waking up to the fact that a lot of the jobs, a lot of the work that we rely on societally, and even just within an organization, but societally more broadly, is done by people who we frequently, and I don't think intentionally, but we frequently take for granted, right? We frequently just assume that people will be there to bag our groceries. We assume that people will be there to work on manufacturing lines. We assume and take for granted that people will show up to do the actual production of goods and services that make our economy run. And when something is taken for granted, I think we tend to not value it as highly, right? And I think for a long time, we haven't had a reason to, as a society, to wake up and realize the incredible value, skills, abilities, and critically important roles that people who often are not sitting at the very high end of organizational hierarchy, but what roles they fill and the incredibly important functions that they perform. And so when COVID hit and it exposed a lot of these things, we started realizing, boy, the people who we really can't afford to lose are the people who are making things and the people who are performing the face-to-face service, right? Those are, that becomes critical. And we use the word essential workers. That's the essential work, right? We have to start valuing that differently. And I also think in my own research, you know, one of the things that I find is that people who come from lower social class environments have a different set of leadership skills, right? They have a different set of skills around building community. They have a different set of skills around operating in resource scarce environments that they are incredibly good at, right? And that organizations could benefit from tremendously if we found ways to make better use of it. Social class is an incredibly important and overlooked area of diversity within organizations that I think we would do well to tap into and understand what resources and what value is being left on the table by not creating environments and contexts where people who have these incredible skills and abilities around things like building community and dealing with scarcity and, you know, people who have demonstrated grit and resilience to bring themselves from lower social class environments up to get to continually perform work and be good performers, those people have demonstrated incredible grit. How do we make use of that? And we're leaving, I think, a tremendous amount of value on the table by not doing more to create organizational cultures and organizational climates where the skills and abilities of those from non-traditional backgrounds are maximized.
Wow. Sean, you just expressed in just 8 or 9 minutes one of the most reflective messages I think I will ever hear in relation to COVID and the impact it's had on leadership, the impact it's had on organizations, the impact it's had on families and face-to-face essential workers. I am so impressed by what you just articulated. That was a very comprehensive perspective on what we're in the midst of. Thank you very much for sharing your reflection.
Well, thank you. That's incredibly kind of you to say. I have to say, I feel a little bit sheepish, though, that it took me 9 minutes to get that out. That was way too long to talk. You feel you're talking. Sorry for going on and on.
Well, this is where we're at. It's such a dynamic situation. We're all learning. The issue of trust and empathy is so critical. I would imagine if you were a leader coming into an organization 2 months leading up to COVID, that it is challenging because you need to have your staff find trust in you in a very dynamic and challenging time. That's an upward climb. And as you stated, trust is something that will be coveted even more so after or during COVID than before COVID. Great expression there.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
What's also exciting is, Sean, you'll be speaking as part of our Q's Knowledge and Networking November. It's a virtual series.
Yes, can't wait.
You'll be speaking about how values can drive organizational direction in crisis. Importantly, the session description notes that it's not necessarily the values on the wall that drive direction, but the values demonstrated by employees' behavior. Would you say more about those differences between the values on the wall and the values demonstrated by employee behavior? What do you mean by those two things?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's an area that I've done a little bit of research in, guided by this really, really classic conceptual framework by this professor named Chris Argyris, who was just incredibly brilliant around organizational culture and organizational values. And he talked about values as existing on two levels. And it's a concept that I've kind of run with in my research too, which is there's the values espoused. And those are the things that are on the wall. Those are the values we hang on our, you know, on our in our framed mission statements and put in our, you know, investor materials and all of that that say things. And by the way, these are the values are important. Those values, they matter, but they're also, they tend to be really generic. I think I saw, this is up to find it, but I think I saw like a Booz Hamilton consulting study a while ago that said something like, 70% of organizations have like basically the same values. You know, like they're the formal values that you always hear, things like we care about reputational excellence, respect and dignity for every employee, honesty and integrity in everything we do. And those are all good, right? Honesty and integrity is important. Respect and dignity is incredibly important, especially this day and age when we're dealing with so many issues around equity and inclusion. And they're all great. Those are wonderful things. Reputational excellence, wonderful. But those are just what people say are important, right? Yeah, those are just what people say are important. People express a very different set of values frequently in what they do. And what I mean by that is the values that are in use and that actually guide their decision-making. So for instance, one of the ones we talk about now with all the, you know, social unrest around issues of equity and diversity and inclusion has to deal with most organizations would say they value diversity. But a lot of internally, the behaviors that the employees do or that they have codified in their hiring practices don't line up with that, right? They don't really put that into practice. That's not a value that is in use. Similarly, you can have a lot of organizations that say things like, we value respect and dignity. And yet if you ask anybody in their organization, what's the culture like here? They would describe it as pretty toxic, right? And that would be a difference between the values that are in use and the values that are on the wall, that are espoused. And I think to the best organizations don't necessarily have completely different values than everybody else. They just have a much tighter alignment between those values that are espoused and those values that are in use. And the difficult thing from a leadership perspective is leaders are definitionally, especially when they reach higher levels of organizational hierarchies, they're definitionally more removed from the day-to-day, right? And so being able to get a accurate pulse of what values are really guiding people's behavior comes really difficult, which speaks to the importance of meeting what we call employee voice, which is people to speak truth to power, to say, you know what, leaders, you all say these are our values, but that's just not what we see down here on the ground. We don't see those types of behaviors. And when you have that kind of a situation where people are pointing out these gaps, we need to turn our eyes back to the systems that we've designed and re-question, are these the right values that we hold? Is this the culture that we want? And if those two don't match up, what are the systems we have in place that are creating the culture that we're seeing? And do we need to start making changes? So that's what I mean by the organizational values and the values that are in use and the values that are espoused. So oftentimes the things we say are important are not the things that necessarily guide our day-to-day decision-making and behavior. And one of those, a small anecdote, one of the ways we manifest this frequently in my MBA classrooms is, and I love when this happens, almost every semester I get some student who talks about, well, look, I mean, this isn't a decision that I would make it for, you know, for me and my family, but this is a business decision. You go, ah, okay, so you're actually completely separating who you are as a person and what you think are important from your business person. Like, you're viewing those as two different people, and they aren't, right? Like, we need to start trying to bridge that gap. Like, why is something that you would make as a business decision completely justifiable when it's something that you wouldn't do if it was to affect your own friends and family? Like, there's a gap here between what you believe to be important in your personal life and the choices that you're making in your business, right? Yeah. And so being able to help identify those and talk about why those gaps exist and how they're affecting the organization is critical, I think, to being able to help people see their leaders as having essentially what we call behavioral integrity, which is they do the things they say they're going to do. They stand for the things that they say are important. Their actions line up with their espoused values. Because if there's one thing, and James, I'll bet you've experienced this too. In all the companies I've worked with, if I would say there is one thing that all followers are incredibly attuned to, that all leaders are not at all attuned to, it is hypocrisy, right? We all, as human beings, that's not an inherent problem with leaders, but we all as human beings are motivated. Our brains are really good at showing why we are not doing something hypocritical for ourselves. Like, yes, I say I value, you know, I believe breaking the law is wrong and that it, I believe that stealing is wrong, but I'm going to download this movie illegally because, yeah, everybody else is doing it. No harm done. We come with all these rationalizations to make it seem like it's not actually a problem. And it doesn't make us bad people. It just makes us people. The folks who don't buy into those rationalizations are our followers. They see that kind of rationalization around a business decision. Around, wait a second, you say respect and dignity is important, and yet look how everybody's treating each other here. There's no rationalizing that away. That's hypocrisy, right? And they focus on that. So, like, being able to help leaders identify where those areas are between their espoused values and the values that are actually in use in their organizations and take steps to fix it is one of the fastest ways we can help create a better culture, help ensure that organizations are designing themselves correctly and using the right systems to perform the way that they want to meet their stakeholders' needs, to meet their employees' needs, and also just to be a good corporate citizen. So, well, again, another long-winded answer about the importance of values.
Thank you for sharing that perspective. Before we go, Sean, I just noticed I saw something on your website. I see that your work has been featured on Comedy Central. That seems an unusual outlet for a business professor. Would you tell me more about that?
It's funny. I didn't target it there. What happened was a TV show on Comedy Central picked up some research that I had written with a colleague of mine, Stefan Cote, and another one of my colleagues, Colonel Todd Woodruff, the United States Military Academy at West Point. And we had written this paper about how growing up with wealth, essentially growing up with privilege or not with privilege, affects the way that people lead when they are adults. So whether, and what we ended up doing in this study was we ended up measuring and sending out a survey to a bunch of officers and their the soldiers below them and their units through the United States military at West Point, a bunch of graduates who are now deployed in the Army. They're West Point grads. And all of them were around the same rank. And we sent them a survey. And we also combined their survey and how their and their followers' ratings of them with some data we got from West Point around, you know, how much their parents essentially made at the time of their college application, right? Because you have, that's one of the things you have to report when you apply to college. And so we were able to essentially find that people who came from higher levels of parental income, parents that made more money, their kids espoused as adults higher levels of narcissism. And that affected the way that they led other people. It led them to engage in fewer of what we consider prototypically beneficial leadership behaviors, like relationship building, openness to change and employee voice and openness to innovation, clearly structuring tasks for their people. And then that effect trickled down to affect their performance later on down the line. And that paper, essentially showing people from wealthier backgrounds ended up being more narcissistic leaders as adults, came out at essentially in 2016, right around the same time as the presidential election and a time that we were all talking about wealth and its effect on people, right? And what is the value of wealth in leadership? And does wealth equate to being a better leader? Does it equate to being smarter? Does it equate to having any kinds of flaws or lack of understanding of people from other backgrounds and so on and so forth? That study came out at a time when socially, there was a lot of interest around the topic. So anyways, a TV show called Midnight with Chris Hardwick had found that research and picked it up and did a whole skit on essentially what it's like to be a child growing up with wealth. It was pretty funny. So that's how that happened. It ended up being featured on a comedy show there.
Yeah, kind of using context at the time of what was going on.
It was, and it's ended up being that. What's funny is that was data. Sometimes the research meets the moment, right? That's not a study that was collected in 2016. You know, research is one of these slow moving things. That was data that had been collected in 2013 before anybody even was aware of what was going to be going on in our country. Certainly from 2016 to now, with social awareness around wealth inequalities and racial progress and so on and so forth. We didn't know anything. That we didn't know that was coming down the pike, but we collected that and it came out at a time when people were really ready for the message.
Sean, thank you so much for spending time with Q's Podcast Nation. It's been a pleasure. I personally enjoyed it. I think our listeners will as well. Thank you for making episode 99 of the Q's Podcast so special.
Oh, thank you, James. I sure appreciate it. I can't wait to connect up in November.
Thank you for taking part in the show. Sean was a lot of fun. Also want to tell you more about the upcoming virtual professional development series we call the Q's Knowledge and Networking November. Seize the opportunity to meet and connect with some of the brightest minds when it comes to leadership, culture, and strategy. Not only will today's guest, Sean Martin, be there, but Harry Kramer, professor at Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, and Francesca Gino, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, will also be there. Each week, they will cover topics that are vital given today's climate and tailored specifically to the credit union industry. Knowledge and Networking November offers a great shared learning opportunity for the employees at your credit union. All sessions will be recorded so you can experience a session again or catch up if you missed one. Our speakers are highly respected experts in their fields, and this is a cost-effective way for your entire team to learn virtually from top-rated speakers. For more information on how to register for Knowledge and Networking November, visit qs.org/KNN. Hey, if you're a Q's member, you have access to invaluable membership benefits to further enhance your development. Visit qs.org/membership to learn more. Q's is an international credit union association. Our mission is to educate and develop credit union CEOs, executives, directors, and future leaders. To learn how Q's can help you realize your potential, visit qs.org today. I look forward to connecting with you and your colleagues on this one-of-a-kind special 100th Q's Podcast episode coming up next.